Good morning.
Morning.
It's great to be here. Today, I'm going to begin by talking about something specific to MZMC, although I think it'll be of wider interest too. And then I'm going to widen things out with a specific teaching of the Buddha. And this morning, I would like to talk a bit about our mission, vision, and values. And this talk is occasioned by the fact that the board has just passed a new version of these things. And so our mission statement and other stuff. And I know some folks think that mission statements aren't very important. No one ever reads them. But I think they are important. They kind of say what we're about as an organization. Sometimes people shop around for a spiritual home and they check out various places, and they may very well look at our mission statement to see what we're all about. And the mission statement that we've been operating under for some time is this. Our mission is to help people experience a deep and quiet joy, a joy that arises whenever we are fully engaged in the work or play of this moment. So our mission is to help people experience a deep and quiet joy, a joy that arises whenever we are fully engaged in the work or play of this one. And I like that mission statement. I think it's great. Deep and quiet joy. I'm glad that joy is in there. Let's hope that joy is part of our practice. And it's about being fully engaged in the work or play of this moment. I like that too. But every so often, it's good to sort of revisit your basic documents and ask if it might be time to make a change. I think we've actually been operating under this one for 18 or 19 years now. So we took a fresh look and we revisited the vision and values as well. And the process was that it began with Ben and I coming up with the words for a new mission statement. I think Ben came up with the initial draft and I changed a few things. And then we consulted Tim, who wrote the prior mission statement, and he changed a few things, I think, in the values. And then we brought it before the board, and the board made some little changes as well. And finally, we approved it. So there were quite a few people who were involved in this. And here's the new mission statement. Minnesota Zen Meditation Center makes a welcoming space for people to awaken wisdom and compassion, to embody Buddhist teachings, to honor our ancestors and descendants, and to joyfully serve our wider communities. So I'll read that one again. Minnesota Zen Meditation Center makes a welcoming space for people to awaken wisdom and compassion, to embody Buddhist teachings, to honor our ancestors and descendants, and to joyfully serve our wider communities. And there's a lot I like about this. It puts welcoming right up front, which I think is something we do here. It's pretty basic to us. Awaken wisdom and compassion, to embody Buddhist teachings. It has that word embody in there. I think this is an embodied practice. And that's very, very important. To honor our ancestors and descendants widens this out to interconnections through time, and to joyfully serve our wider communities widens it out in geography to our wider communities. And joy is still in there. Our vision is very short. We envision a world grounded in generosity, compassion, and wisdom. And then our values. These core principles define our mission and guide our MZMC community. And there are seven of them. And by the way, these are on our website if you'd like to ever look them up. I'm not sure if the new ones are on there yet or the old ones, but these will be on there soon if they're not on there now. So compassion, knowing that all is interdependent and nothing is separate from ourselves, we strive to be compassionate in all our activities. So compassion is first. That's appropriate, I think. tradition. We embrace the Buddhist and Soto Zen teachings and practices that have been handed down to us. We honor the people who have embodied the tradition and passed it on. So tradition is important to us here. We're not going to stop being a Soto Zen center. A variety of practices is really great, but here we feel a responsibility to carry on this tradition that we were taught by Katagiri when he founded the center, and which has been taught for many generations. However, we're not rigid about it. We're adaptable, hence the next one, practice. We value and are open to new and different approaches to the practice of Zen Buddhism. We honor the needs of our community and seek to listen and incorporate feedback. So we welcome new and different approaches. We're still adapting Zen to North America, and we honor the needs of our community, and we want communication in our community. Next, community. A spirit of cooperation guides our relationships with each other within the Zen Center community. We support and encourage one another on our spiritual paths and in our daily activities. Community is pretty basic here, pretty basic. Equity and inclusion. We welcome every person who seeks to do Zen practice. We work to remove barriers based on race, ethnicity, gender identity, religion, class, sexual orientation, age, and ability. We thrive by celebrating what we share and our differences. And I think this is pretty deep in the fabric of our community as well. Finally, engagement. We are committed to being fully engaged in our day-to-day life with family and friends, at work and play, and with the larger community, nation, and world in which we live. So being fully engaged, not just in our immediate surroundings, but with the larger world is basic to our values. So there it is. And the teaching I would like to go to is the six recollections, which is in a book I've been reading with Jiryu Matt Sisler for some time. So this caught my attention because it's kind of about the wider world that I was just talking about. So it's a good, it fits with the values pretty well, I think. I'd like to emphasize, I'm not saying that our values are only about sort of action in the wider world. That's one thing our values are about, but that's something I would like to stress today. So Jiryu and I have been reading this book. It's called In the Buddha's Words, an Anthology of Discourses from the Pali Canon, edited by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So these are the teachings of the Buddha. And we get together every 2 or 3 weeks and we read a little bit aloud. And we've been doing this for about 3 years now. And we're on page, I think, 280-something. And we've got quite a ways to go. So it's a long-term project, you could say. And it's a beautiful book and really very fascinating. People communicated in a different way back in those days. You know, most folks were illiterate. And the Buddha would give these talks, and nothing was written down. And actually for centuries after the Buddha first spoke. And so the style is a little different. There's a lot of repetition so that people will remember it. It's quite different, but really very wonderful. And so the six recollections, something in here really grabbed my attention the other day. It just kind of fell into my lap. So yes, this Dharma talk came together. So for those of you who are really into the Pali Canon, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, which is the fourth division of the Sutta Pitaka. And so it begins. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kapilavatthu in the Banyan Tree Monastery. So Kapilavatthu is the capital city of the Shakya tribe, which Shakyamuni Buddha was a member of. It is in the foothills of modern Nepal, and that's where the Buddha's palace was before he was the Buddha, the palace that he fled. And he went off and became enlightened and got a lot of followers. And then throughout his life, he would return here to Kapilavatthu and speak. So basically, he's returned to his hometown to do some teaching here in the Banyan Tree Monastery. That's nice. How many have ever seen a banyan tree? Not many. I hope to see a banyan tree one day. Then Mahanama the Shakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, so Mahanama is a close relative of the Buddha and he's a prominent member of the Shakyan clan. Paid homage to him, or is it homage? Could be three bows, I'm not sure. Sat down to one side, because I don't think you sit straight on in front of the Buddha, that would be disrespectful. And said, venerable sir, in what way does a noble disciple often dwell when he has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching? So how does a disciple dwell when you've arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching? When I first read this, I thought, oh, he's asking, how does a fully enlightened person act? But it's not a person who is fully enlightened, because arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching are terms associated with the phase of stream enterer, which is actually the first of four stages. There's also once returner, non-returner, and worthy one or arhat. So this is a question about someone who has just entered the stream. And that is someone who has attained an initial vision of the reality of nirvana. It is said that people who heard the Buddha speak in person instantly attained that. But these are people like many of us. They've really gotten some pretty deep insight into the Buddha's teachings. There's a ways to go, but they are sort of understanding the beauty and the benefits of those teachings. And the Buddha gives his answer. When Mahanama, a noble disciple has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, he often dwells in such a way as this. Here, a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata thus, the Tathagata being Buddha. The Blessed One is an arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. So his answer is, how do you dwell? You recollect the Buddha in his perfection. So keep this image of enlightenment in your mind. When a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata thus, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. His mind is straight with the Tathagata as its object. So if you keep this image of the enlightened Buddha in your mind, you will not be obsessed by lust, hatred, delusion, etc. It's not so much that you're driving that stuff out, you're inviting something wonderful into your mind, so there won't be room for all of that stuff, which is really not helpful. So I'm reading this the first time, and I'm thinking, okay, I like to try sort of new techniques, new things, even though I've been practicing for quite a long time. So I can do that. The next time I get agitated, I may... just imagine the serene Buddha, really bring that into my mind and see what happens there. So continuing. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains the inspiration of the meaning, the inspiration of the Dhamma or Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is gladdened, he or she, or they are gladdened, rapture arises. For one uplifted by rapture, the body becomes calm. One calm in body feels happy. For one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. So this is just a little bit on sort of the benefits of practice. And I like it. It's not sort of that sort of appeal to the baser instincts that we sometimes see. You know, you'll get a whole lot of merit and you'll get lovely things if you do this practice. These things like a calm mind are just more consistent with our practice. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amid an uneven population, who dwells without affliction amid an afflicted population, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the Buddha. And so this is what really caught my attention. How do we remain even in an uneven world? How do we remain unafflicted in an afflicted world? Because there is agitation all around us. And this has been on my mind a lot lately. I'm sure it's been on all of our minds that there are, you know, the wider world, there are a lot of things going on. There's climate change, which is pretty dramatic. Today it might be 67 degrees and it's March 3rd. Things are just, it's sort of the winter that wasn't. Now, some of that may be El Nino, but I think some of it is surely related to climate change. And also, regardless of where we are on the political spectrum, whether we're way over on the left or way over on the right or in the middle, we would probably, most of us agree that there's a bit of a crisis going on right now. And sometimes we get scared. So this question of how we dwell evenly in an uneven world, how we dwell in an unafflicted way in an afflicted world is a very important. And moreover, I would add, maybe from a little more of a Mahayana and action-oriented point of view, how do we also make this crisis better? So, on to the second recollection. Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Dhamma thus. So first you recollect the Buddha, now we're recollecting the Dharma. If you're familiar with the Pali Canon, this is not too surprising because they tend to say one thing and a whole lot of stuff about it, and then say another thing and the same stuff about that, basically. And they have a list. So we have Buddha and Dharma. What might be next? We'll see. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise. I was really delighted by this line. You know why? Because the Dhamma, it's not in the books. It's not in what the Buddha is saying. It is directly visible. It is immediate. It is inviting one to come and see. It is to be personally experienced by the wise. To me, that sounds really very Zen. It's just right here, right now. That's what it is. That's what it is. And I'm always happy to find stuff that sounds really Zen in the Buddha's original teachings. Because see, it was there all along. It's not like we changed it. We changed the emphasis. That's what we changed. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma thus, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. His mind is straight with the Dhamma as its object. And you can see that's the repetition kicking in. When Jiryu and I read this, we always read the repetitive stuff. We never say, you know, whatever. Because it's kind of like a meditation, you know. We like to repeat it over and over. But the editor of the book has helpfully put in here, dot, 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 dot. This is called a noble disciple who dwells evenly amid an uneven population, who dwells without affliction amid an afflicted population, who has entered upon the stream of the Dhamma and develops recollection of the Dhamma. Okay, so I'll try something new. When I'm agitated, I'll bring the teaching to mind. How am I going to do that? I don't think I want to picture the books in the library because that's just too much going on. I'm going to picture this immediate, personally experienced reality. I think I'm going to picture the lake. That's the teaching of the Buddha. When I can see it, it presents itself to me. It invites me to come and see. I'm going to picture the lake. See how that goes. Okay, those are first two things to recollect. Further Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects the Sangha thus. Okay, not too surprising. We're completing Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three jewels here.
That's going to the car.
The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. So nice things about the Sangha. The Sangha practices the good way. I thoroughly believe that myself. And then there's this thing worthy of a little digression. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. And I didn't know what those were. So I looked up, I have the Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism, which is a massive tome. And in the back of it, it has a list of lists, which is 37 large, dense pages with all the things there are two of, all the things there are three of, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of fun. It could be a real rabbit hole, right? Because we could read all of that and we could get so stuck on the list and stay in our head all the time. So you have to approach this kind of cautiously. And remember, this is in service of the lake, not in service of our brains. So I could not find the four pairs of persons. I think I did find the eight types of individuals, which is also the eight noble persons, which is candidate for fruit of stream enterer, recipient of fruit of stream enterer, etc. So the point is the Sangha is for all layers, or all levels, I should say, all levels of development, if there's such a thing as development. So this Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is worthy of gifts. We'll be passing the Dana bowl later. Worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When a noble disciple recollects the Sangha thus, his mind or her mind or their mind is not obsessed, etc. So I can remember the Sangha next time I'm agitated. I will remember this scene, and I will probably become less agitated. And now, the next recollection, what will it be? We've done Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Will we have another thing that normally comes in threes? Well, let's see. Further Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own moral discipline thus. Okay.
Well, you'll be back probably by 10 anyway.
I am to recollect my own moral discipline, my own virtue to inspire me. And
okay.
I might wonder, is that a good thing
all
to
right.
Remember?
Well, have a good day.
My own discipline very well, and I don't think it's perfect, but actually it's a great thing to remember, because if we believe that there is a perfect Buddha and we are Buddha, it has to
no
be.
You don't it's
and
a
we
big
can
car
think of what's best in us, and that can inspire us, and we know what's best in us is there in all of humanity. And furthermore, we must think of what's best in us, because we can't leave ourselves out of the compassion of the world. So we think thus, I possess
no.
the moral virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken,
the roads are looks like
unblemished,
look like
unmottled, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped,
yeah,
leading to concentration. I like ungrasped. No rabbit hole for us. We're not going to grab onto things when we're thinking of these virtues. And then when we recollect thus, our mind is not obsessed, We dwell evenly among an uneven population, etc. So I can try this too. I can remember myself at my best. I might think of myself on retreat when my mind has very much settled and I'm very much in the immediate moment and I'm very much connected to the people around me
in an effortless way.
Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects their own generosity. So, a second quality of myself to remember. Thus, it is a gain for me, it is well gained by me, that in a population obsessed by the stain of stinginess, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess. So this is the first time here we get a little description of what it is about the world that makes it so agitated. It is stingy, greedy, materialistic, people obsessed with getting stuff, with the fulfillment of desire, right? People who mistakenly believe that fulfilling desires is the way to happiness. The Four Noble Truths tells us that that is not the way. But in this world, obsessed by the stain of stinginess, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. So, okay, I can remember a time when I was very charitable, giving money perhaps, or giving my time, or being generous in speech, or being kind to the planet. I can think of my grandfatherly mind, and this will help me to dwell evenly. And then finally, what will the next one be? Further, Mahanama, a noble disciple, develops the recollection of the divas thus. Well, this surprises me. The divas, I thought this would be another straightforward third quality that's in me, but this is a little different and a little surprising. There are divas in the various heavenly realms. And perhaps you've seen pictures of the divas. We have the six realms, which are regarded by some people as realms where we go in a rebirth. We may go to the animal realm, which is kind of a step down, or the hungry ghost realm, or the hell realm. Or we may go to the diva realm, which is sort of a god realm. But most folks, I think around here, think of these more as mental states that we fall in as a result of how we are. And so the divas are, literally, it means shining one. They're not immortal. They can't stay in this heavenly realm forever, but they do stay there for a long, long time. And they have a very long, happy life. And they're sometimes pictured like living in the clouds and they're playing musical instruments. And it's like one long, beautiful, refined party. And they get there as a fortunate rebirth due to their kind acts. So how is it going to help us to recollect these divas on their clouds? Well, there is found in me such faith, moral discipline, learning, generosity, and wisdom as those divas possessed, because of which, when they passed away from this world, they were reborn there. So we remember not so much their beautiful lives, but the beautiful actions they engaged in that allowed them to be reborn in me. So again, we are remembering our own good deeds. And when we recollect those qualities, our mind is straight and we dwell evenly, etc. Our mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. Remember, again, we let in the good stuff, so there's not so much room for the bad stuff. And I might add worry to that, worry and agitation. If we let in these beautiful things in our mind, there might be less room for worry and agitation. A noble disciple, Mahanama, who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, often dwells in just this way. And that's the end. I want to stress often. If we do this technique, we will often dwell in this way. Not always. No guarantee. And if you go for always, you're just going to be disappointed. But we try to do more. Be happy more. So is this the answer? Is this the answer to our immediate problem of a very agitated world with many, many problems? This 2,500-year-old teaching, which was delivered to illiterate monks in the Banyan Tree Monastery, which involves simply bringing a few things into your mind, is that going to help us with this problem? I would say yes, because this practice is about going inside and finding the evenness that is needed to cope. And not just the evenness to cope, if I may take a more Mahayana view, the evenness to respond and act, because action is so basic to what we do. So I can recall the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, my own moral discipline at its best, my own generosity, all the good qualities that led to my best ways of being. I can recall those things in my friends, and that will help me. And I need this now, because when it comes to the agitation in the world, and I think I must return to this topic, I sense, and I want to say this in the most gentle and compassionate way possible, I sense a kind of a passivity in a lot of people in the face of troubling events. Now, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. Maybe it's just me. But sometimes I feel that. And I wonder, what is this? Are we just worn out? Maybe we are. Maybe we're worn down. We've had some tough years here, some really tough years. But we can't use that as an excuse. I think of my parents' generation. You know, my parents grew up in the Great Depression, and then there was World War II, and my dad went to the Army, and my mom worked in the post office, and then that ended, and they had kids, and it wasn't always easy, and farming was not easy, and then they had the Cold War, which was terrifying, and they persisted through all of that, and they hardly talked about it, and hardly complained. So, or maybe I wonder, do we sometimes feel that things are all being decided by forces beyond our control, that we really can't affect events? I think that could be. There are some events we can't affect. But the important thing is that there are many events we really can affect. And we have to know the difference, right? And work on the things that we can change. And I have a lot of confidence that we can do things because, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and I just all my life will have this feeling we stopped the war. We stopped the war. And I thought, you know, my generation, or a little older than me, were pretty cool because of all that agitation stopping the Vietnam War. But, of course, it didn't come from us. It came from the civil rights movement a little earlier. That's where this great resistance and this great ability to change things came from Martin Luther King and folks like that. But the point is that people really made a difference. And I think an example of where we can make a difference now, regardless of your political views, if you want to advance your own political views, I think that in electoral politics, we can make a really big difference. And some people would disagree with me, I'm sure, and would probably make some good points. But I think that this might be about the most important thing. For me, the most important thing I can do right now is to engage in electoral politics and actively support candidates or give money. And there are other ways to help as well, myriad ways, direct and indirect. But first, we must dwell evenly among an uneven population. So, one thing I think it's helpful to do is to reduce the noise. We all want to stay informed, and we should stay informed, but do it in small doses, because too much news can make us a little wacky. Too much internet. And we know there are these algorithms I'm just watching this documentary on YouTube, and there are these algorithms that channel you toward more and more outrage and sort of more and more extreme views. Resist that kind of thing. And, you know, take in the way Thich Nhat Hanh interprets the precept about intoxicants is be careful about what you allow into your mind. So be a little quiet, be appropriately aware, go inside and do the deep work, whether that's with the six recollections or the other practices, so as to be able to act when it's needed, both at Zen Center and here in the wider world. So now I'd like to hear from you. Would anyone like to contribute? Yes, Barb.
I turned my TV off in the beginning of January. That's wonderful.
Really? You haven't watched your TV since January. And it's wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Give me a second here. Let's see, if you're online, you can raise your hand or just start speaking. Anyone else in the room here? Leslie.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. Appreciate what you had to say. And yeah, I get overwhelmed sometimes. I drive at 9 a lot, and I listen to NPR, and there comes a point that I put on a book, you know, and listen to an audio book. Granted, there's usually some dilemma going on in the audio book, but it's not what, you know, what we're facing. And that feeling of helplessness is pretty strong. I mean, even with participation in politics and all that, it still feels pretty hopeless sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things I do besides filtering that is I try to, maybe this is counterintuitive, I try to bring it up occasionally with people who seem to want to not think about it, because it's real easy to not want to think about it. And learning how to gently remind people, one of the things I say when we're talking about the weather is, with people, I'll say, yeah, you know, there's that silver lining for the climate crisis, because I think that it's important that we do remember what's happening, or we'll do nothing.
And, absolutely.
And I see people that do nothing or want to just kind of not think about that because it's unpleasant. And so I think it's important that finding that balance, always finding the balance, right, is one of the most difficult things, I think, for me in doing this. And it's important to, you know, coming here and thinking about the things that are unchanging, the things that are not touched by all that's going on, is important for my sanity to do that. And coming here kind of reminds me of that. So, anyway, thanks for your talk. I appreciated it very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for speaking to balance, because it's very important. Yes, Jim.
And I also want to thank you for your talk and also your emphasis on the importance of taking action. Mm-hmm. As you said, the civil rights struggle and the struggle against the Vietnam War were successful actions. And I think that the emphasis on electoral politics is so important, because that's the opportunity that the vast masses can actually engage in, at least initially, to make action. And I just think it's so important that people remember that there are opportunities for change. And the election this year is a tremendous opportunity for a lot of people to make change. And we've seen what happens when people do not make changes. So thank you again.
Thank you, Jim. Yes, Diana.
Thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed the way in which the recollections get unpacked from the thing that we feel is the furthest from us, which is Buddha, all the way to the closest thing, which is us and what we can do and what lives inside of us. And I think that when we center ourselves in all of that, that really helps us ground ourselves and steel ourselves for the things that are really hard.
Mm-hmm. Nicely said. Thank you. Okay. Yes, Katie.
So how do you approach the that constant question of, am I doing enough? You know, if we can embody the values, we can create peace in our immediate surroundings. There's always this feeling I should be doing more, which I don't know how helpful that is or to what degree.
Yeah, that is a good and a difficult question. How do I approach the idea that I'm not doing enough and I should do more? And I don't know if I have a consistent approach there. On the one hand, I need to be kind of forgiving, because it's not helpful to sort of dwell in this feeling of inadequacy, like I'm just not doing anything, I'm worthless, etc. We can get all these stories going that are not very helpful. On the other hand, we don't want to be complacent, and we do want to kind of light a fire under ourselves from time to time and encourage ourselves. I think I try to take the deep view. Sometimes I take a deep look at my life and I ask, well, what am I doing? You know, I'm not out there a lot. I don't go to a lot of public events. Sometimes I do. I'm not out there working in organizations so much, but I am here and I am supporting this community, and I do talks like this, and I feel okay about that. So, you know, pretty good about that. So it's kind of a combination of trying to think about the things I am doing that are encouraging, and maybe I'll just leave it at that. Trying to sort of find that balance. And sometimes I do say to myself, you know, I don't think you are doing this. There's a place for that too. So that is a fairly muddled answer. Good luck. Yes.
So going back to the reading, I like the idea of recognizing the good that we do, right? Finding the Kiva state, and you know, whether it's picturing yourself playing the harp on a cloud or whatever that is, but to recognize that the things that we do really do matter.
Yeah.
That'd be forgiving.
Right. And that relates to Katie's question, I think, too.
Right.
Just, yeah, let's remember and celebrate the good things that we are doing.
Yeah. I had a question about this good phrase, gladdened rapture, which sounds a little like falling in love.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like something happens. I always think of rapture as this pretty intense thing. It's not nothing. What do you make of that phrase?
I remember once after a sesshin down at Hokyoji, 3-day sesshin, I went up to Joan Snyder O'Neill and I said, can I ask you a question? You know, she was much more senior. She was a senior teacher. And I said, you know, gee, I've just been feeling so, so good during this retreat. I feel kind of a rapture. Is that okay? And she said, enjoy the rapture. So I thought, okay, I will. And it is really an interesting thing, because the kind of joy we get from this practice isn't sort of about fulfillment of desire. And yet we can feel this kind of rapture. It's kind of like falling in love. It feels wonderful. I think when we feel that way, it's like big mind knowing that little mind is happy, and isn't that wonderful? If we have some perspective on it, so it's not going to fuel more desire, but rather it's going to be like, oh, that's good, you know, I'm happy the way the world should be happy, then it's okay.
Yeah, it's cool that it leads then to calm.
To calm.
It leads to calm.
Right, rather than more need. Yeah. Thank you. Let's see what time it is. Maybe one more, Leo?
I'd like to commend Barbara for turning her TV off.
Absolutely.
I remember good life, maybe some of them. my neighbor and I would go for walks on Saturday and solve all the problems of the world. I come back to my house, drink coffee. course, we don't have enough money to implement our solution. We were talking yesterday. We as a society don't talk about things. You remember when you were younger, you got all your news. There were sports channels. Everyone got their news from these sports channels. People talk about what they saw on TV the night before. We don't do that anymore. Look how many channels there are.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many sources of information. My neighbor's brother, he's a hardcore right-winger. A month ago, she asked him about who he was voting for. Of course, you know, what good to say. But a month ago, he didn't even know who Nikki Haley is. And it's for someone to be in this, within this society, with all the information we get going into our minds every day, not knowing who the second person in the Republican Party, it's amazing. It boggles my mind. So I think we just have to pay attention, especially this year. It's going to be a big election. Things will change. Thank you for your thought.
Thank you. All right, let's stop there and turn it over to Ardoan.